This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Etopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to talk to Dr. Clifford McDonald, who's a medical epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. He's in Atlanta right now. We talked to him last time from Taiwan. Welcome back to Etopia Media Medical News Network.
Thank you, sir.
What we want to talk about is an update on the Clostridium difficile bacterium and what it's been doing. What exactly has been your professional relationship with this microbe?
Well, as we spoke last time, we recently reported on our findings of a common strain that has caused outbreaks in hospitals in six different states, seven hospitals in six different states. Since that interview, we've heard more from Canada and the problems they're facing, mostly in Montreal, in other parts of Quebec and perhaps some areas in Ontario, but specifically I think 10 or 12 hospitals in Montreal that have been affected with outbreaks. And, we, working with Dr. Vivian Liu, who's the head investigator in Montreal, and then also Andre Daskal and in the laboratory there, have determined that the strain that they are grappling with in Montreal and other parts of Quebec is one and the same as the strain that we are dealing with in the United States.
So the one down here is just as antibiotic resistant and just as virulent as the one in Canada.
Yes, it has the same some of the same molecular findings when we did the molecular testing and showed that it has this extra toxin. Andre Daskal's lab also has determined this, that it has this extra binary toxin. And then also this deletion in that we talked about last time, which is a gene that normally turns down, if you will, like a rheostat, turning down the amount of toxin production. That has been damaged, or it has a small segment of DNA that's taken out of that gene, and we think that maybe its function is impaired, and it could lead to increased toxin production. So that's the virulent side of the thing that we think might be there. But then the resistance, as you mentioned, there's the fluoroquinolone resistance, which is this large class of, or important class of antibiotics that are used for a variety of infections, and they're used commonly by physicians both in Canada and the United States. And it's thought that maybe the widespread use of those antibiotics might have a role in the development of these outbreaks.
Okay, let me ask you just to speak a little louder.
Okay.
On that basis, then, I've been researching some of the extra steps that are being taken now as possible more advanced treatments against this bacterium.
Sure.
One of them is called ramoplanin, mm-hmm. Which apparently works by interfering with the production of the cell walls that are necessary for the reproduction of C. difficile. Is that right? And what is the approach that this new antibiotic is going to take?
Well, it'll be another antibiotic when it gets approved, and assuming that it is approved eventually, that could be used for treating a patient who has the diarrhea or the disease from the C. diff. And that would be important, is to have another form of treatment. Right now, the standard treatment is an antibiotic called metronidazole. That's often the first line treatment, and that's the standard therapy both in the United States and in Canada. And then if patients don't respond to that antibiotic, there's another antibiotic called vancomycin. Both of these are administered orally, preferentially. And then if that doesn't work, then there's some other treatments out there. But those are the main two antibiotic treatments to actually kill or eradicate, or attempt to eradicate. We don't really eradicate, but decrease the numbers of the C. diff.
And how well do those two agents seem to work?
Well, they don't work in every case, and we sometimes also especially have problems with recurrences sometimes with them. Some patients will tend to recur. There's ramoplanin is one of these antibiotics. There's another one that's under development called rifalazil. It's also early in its development. There's also, just so our listeners know of some of the other emerging therapies, there's a toxin binding agent which is actually administered orally. It's under development called tolevamir. And the idea there is you bind the toxin and try to decrease the disease by binding the toxin.
Is that the same thing as CDA1?
I don't think so. I think CDA1 is the code for the monoclonal antibody.
Right, it is.
Yeah, that's another emerging therapy. It was just reported on some of the initial results at that meeting that we presented at Infectious Disease Society of America at the beginning of this month. That's a monoclonal antibody that's directed against the toxin. There's also a vaccine under development of it that's very early stage. And then other people have been doing in the past things with probiotics, and we might have talked about that last time, giving people other bacteria, healthy bacteria, to repopulate the intestines and other things. But let's talk a little bit about that monoclonal and the idea that some people recur. And one problem with people recurring, lots of times we know now, is that they don't develop antibodies. It's been shown some people, you know, even in the hospital, younger people especially, they might get exposed to the Clostridium difficile. They might even get colonized. They might even be on some antibiotics for some time and get colonized, but they don't go on and develop the disease. And one reason is we think that it might be because they develop antibodies. And by developing antibodies to the toxin, they don't seem to go on and get disease. So that's where this idea of either giving a monoclonal antibody, in other words, give them the antibody in a pure form and inject it, and that might reduce the recurrences, or even vaccinate. That's the idea of a vaccination, come at it from even before someone gets disease. These are different these are different approaches. One is secondary prevention after someone gets the disease, and the other is primary prevention, giving someone a vaccine or trying to prevent transmission.
So essentially the two ways of defeating it would be to kill the C. difficile, or to give the patient either from the outside or by vaccinating from the inside the ability to fight off the infection themselves. Okay, well, now, so there are three or four different approaches here that are being used. What's the timing of the development process versus the spread of the disease process? Are these going to be ready in a timely way, or is the disease spreading faster than the research projects can be developed to defeat it or suppress it?
Well, my understanding is that probably of all these agents, the toxin binding is probably the farthest along in the FDA. I think that's phase 3 or 4.
What's the name of that again?
That's tolevamir.
Right.
And ramoplanin also, I think, is and you reported on this recently, so you might know better. I think at phase 3, or just trying to get some of those phase 3 studies done. The monoclonal antibody is still very early. I think they're just talking about phase 1, just doing the initial testing in humans. I think the vaccine's the same stage.
So when can the earliest ones be ready, would you say?
I think we're looking at 5 years or so for most of them. Maybe some of those would be a little bit sooner, like the tolevamir might be a little bit sooner. But that's probably still a 2 to 3 year range.
Okay. So then meanwhile, what are the prospects for the spreading of the bacterium in Canada, in the United States, and especially in terms of back and forth? You said the strain in the United States that's causing the most trouble is the same as the strain in Canada, but maybe the one in the Canada, it's a different colony of the same ones. It may be a little more powerful, especially in populations that haven't been exposed to it. What are the epidemiological prospects for it to be transferred to the United States? Does it take one patient in Quebec to travel to New York to get treatment, or just to think he's or she is better and then spread it there? And what are the issues there?
Well, you've touched on some good points. It presumably all it needs to be, in fact, is just one patient. Yeah, you're right, just one patient. And frankly, we think right now that that's probably already happened. We think that actually the strain in Canada is one and the same as the one that we've seen in Maine and in other states in the United States.
Is it likely if the same in Maine and Canada, did it come from Canada to Maine or go from Maine to Canada?
Well, it's been pointed out by some folks that some of the outbreaks in the United States predated the ones in Canada.
Right.
But in fact, we don't really know this. We have some evidence to suggest this strain, or the ancestors to this strain, have been around in North America since the 1980s. So it could even be that it kind of evolved uniquely on either side of the border. We don't even know on which side, and maybe it just wasn't detected.
In fact, have the treatments been generally, due to the internationalization of medical practice, were the treatments that were used in the United States against this sort of ancestor strain the same as the ones that were used in Canada, and could that be a good experiment to prove that that kind of treatment ends up generating this kind of more virulent...
I think you mentioned these antibiotics, and yes, the fluoroquinolones have been used on both sides of the border extensively. They've become, an important workhorse in treating antibiotic workhorse in treating pneumonias and urinary tract infections and a lot of other common infections.
Right.
And so then
have they been used in Europe? Is this a resin in Europe?
Fluoroquinolones, sure, they're used there too. And we have not tested any strains from Europe, but that's a good point. We've heard reports that in England they're having problems with Clostridium difficile. We don't know yet what strain that is.
Okay, now we talked about a little bit about how this is generated, what we've just been talking about, by the overzealous use of antibiotics. The Health Minister of Quebec apparently this week made the same point and said that the hospital officials and doctors should be more judicious in their use of the antibiotics. Is that a good sign or a desperate sign or what?
Well, no, I think it is an important sign. We don't know exactly how aggressive right now we should be with this, but we've been saying that, for quite some time for a whole host of reasons, not just the Clostridium difficile. And we're saying that generally, with all antibiotics, prudent antibiotic use, well, usually it's been, the focus has been to try to prevent resistance in the organism you're treating. In this case, it's a little bit different because we know an antibiotic is actually a risk factor for getting the disease.
Right.
It's a little unique. We talked about that last time, that you actually won't get the Clostridium difficile disease, even if you have the organism in you, unless you've received antibiotics wiping out the healthy bacteria.
Right.
So that's always a good message, always important. But I think it might be even another step that we have to look at, and I'm not saying we're recommending this at this time, but that is, would it be beneficial to even restrict certain classes of antibiotics?
Right.
To try to control this. And we know historically that another drug that was associated with outbreaks of C. diff, clindamycin, back at different times, well, it's happened several times since the 1970s. Clindamycin has been associated with outbreaks. And in the hospitals where they've had that, they've sometimes resorted to restricting that particular antibiotic and seen an improvement in their rates in response to that. So do we need to do something like that again? It'd be a little bit more radical with the fluoroquinolones because, boy, they've become so important.
Now, more generally, are there ways to treat these problems like pneumonia other than using antibiotics?
I'm not really up on that. Certainly vaccination is important. That's not what I mean by not up on it. That's not my main focus.
Right.
But vaccinations wherever possible, and in influenza vaccine when it's available, and wherever it's available to those at high risk. And then pneumonia vaccine. There's a pneumococcus vaccine because that's the most common bacterial cause of pneumonia. That's certainly important also.
So that goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago in terms of the choice between killing the bacteria or vaccinating against
right.
it. You're saying if we vaccinated against pneumonia, then the body's immune system, as altered, would be able to defeat the invading microbes, and it wouldn't be necessary to use antibiotics.
Certainly, that's the intention. That would be also the goal of trying to preserve antibiotics, their lifespan and whatnot, to try to reduce the number of persons infected.
Okay, now a very interesting issue arose just this week on the use of gastric acid suppressant agents like Nexium and Zantac. It was suggested by a Dr. Dial, Dial in Montreal, that giving those to patients or patients that had those and increased the likelihood that the Clostridium difficile, once in the body, once in the stomach, would survive to get to the intestine, the large intestine. And there was a big report in the Journal of American Medical Association about the association of increased risk of pneumonia with people who are taking these agents. What's the current thinking about that?
Yeah, the pneumonia link in that I know has been discussed for some time, and this issue with the Clostridium difficile being more likely if people are on these agents, it's been shown in several studies, including that one by Dial et al., Dr. Dial and colleagues from Montreal. And in fact, we found the same in an outbreak investigation we did in Maine. So we found the same that patients who were receiving these medications that are very powerful and effective at knocking down the amount of stomach acid, that they're associated with an increased risk of getting the Clostridium difficile. And it makes sense, because we know that a healthy level of stomach acid is probably our first defense against any type of bacterial infection of the intestines, because those bacteria are getting there, of course, via the stomach.
So they're very much, the stomach is really the guardians at the gate, and the acid is the guardian at the gate, and when it's put out of commission, then the bacteria get a free ride in.
Right.
What does that mean, that people are going to have to stop using those agents for all of the problems that GERD and other problems that they're prescribed for?
Well, they've certainly become very useful in modern medical care, and I guess one question that we need to look at further also is, are we seeing increase in other kinds of foodborne, say, bacterial diseases because of the widespread use? I don't personally have a lot of data right now on how widespread these are used. Certainly in the healthcare facilities that are being used a lot. Is it affecting the incidence of foodborne diseases out in the community? I don't know, but that would be another issue that might make us reconsider or relook at those and how they're being used.
Because I think of E. coli, for example, is very much born that way, right? It's in food, you eat it. And
or food and water. Well, yeah, food primarily
water.
In the country, yeah. And travelers' diarrhea overseas, probably in the water also. But, yeah, the E. coli O157 that has caused food outbreaks before, that's in the food. The Salmonella that causes food outbreaks in Campylobacter, these agents are all ingested.
Would you know or imagine that more epidemiological studies are being done now to study that?
Yeah, well, I know, for example, that the issue of stomach acid has always been recognized. Also, the issue of antibiotics have been recognized for those also, because just as in the case of Clostridium difficile, taking an antibiotic decreases your defenses by having the healthy bacteria in your intestines, it also decreases your defenses to Salmonella and other foodborne diseases. So I'm certainly familiar that the foodborne group here at CDC has always been aware of that, and in fact, I'll be working with them coming up shortly. We'll be consulting on some of these matters. So I think it's an area that we need to actively look at.
Okay, let me ask you one specific question, one general one. I interviewed someone in New Brunswick, Canada this week at a company called Zapatol that makes UVC systems that zap C. difficile, and they were saying bovine spongiform encephalopathy agents and so on with ultraviolet rays, light. Is that a promising, a useful, or a
way? I don't really know
way.
The data on UV lights for surface disinfection.
Right.
The other area that UV lights have been used is in disinfecting the air.
Right.
In many parts of the world, and even in the United States, I think that there is a place for the UV lights to disinfect air as a part of controlling tuberculosis, which is airborne.
Right.
This idea, and I think one of the reasons that it's being approached this way is that we know that a lot of the hospital disinfectants are probably not powerful enough to kill this Clostridium difficile when it gets into its spore or dormant form.
Right.
And I think we talked about this last time, I'm not sure, but of course these bacteria do form spores, which makes them difficult to clean off the environment. So,
in fact, this is the same defensive approach that anthrax uses.
Right. Well, exactly. The anthrax forms spores also, and so chlorine or Clorox bleach is oftentimes the only cleaner that can be used. And of course, that's corrosive for a lot of surfaces and causes a lot of vapors. So there is reason to certainly be looking at other means of cleaning things. My one concern would be just not that I've studied this particular thing, would be that you'd still need to have good cleaning. And I think this is always one thing we come back to, is that whatever disinfectant we use, you also have to use the disinfection of elbow grease. In other words, good cleaning where you get all the organic material off. You need to have a good clean surface to begin with and then apply the disinfectant.
Okay, now there's the word nosocomial.
Nosocomial,
a disease that's created in the hospital.
Uh-huh.
It looks like that two of the main causes of the C. difficile outbreaks, as we've been examining it, are overuse of antibiotics and possibly now the overuse of gastric acid suppressants. Is this a man-made epidemic? Is this a problem that was going to cause us to reconsider our entire approach, this kind of aggressive, let's kill them or suppress them approach to medicine, or is it that important?
Well, it's as you mentioned, the word nosocomial is any kind of healthcare setting associated infection, and so you could say that any of those, and there's a lot of different ones, and Clostridium difficile is one of them. It's a very important one. Any of those are associated with the advances in medical care, whether we put an IV catheter in a person and then they get infected from the IV catheter, or you perform a life-saving surgery and they get an infection there. All those are, of course, side effects, if you will, of advances in medical care. The antibiotic resistance issue has already been out there, of course, for many years and well understood that it's because we're using antibiotics that have some activity that are useful, that they develop, that they select for the resistant strains of the organism, and that's what we're seeing here also in a way. But yeah, this is just more of that, and I think it's sort of a magnification of that too. And I think especially in this case because, and we talked about this last time, the antibiotics are really the risk factor, not just for resistance in the Clostridium difficile, but for actually getting a disease. You know, we've often, a lot of clinicians have always felt like in the past that antibiotics are safe and they're effective and they cause no harm. This is a case where they do cause harm.
And in fact, the important part of the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm.
Right, and you can't, always our goal. Right.
Right. Does that mean that, again, what we talked about once or twice today, that an approach that stresses the enhancement of the human immune system rather than the attack on the microbes when they appear is likely to get more emphasis?
Right. I think that's one thing that I think that's a logical conclusion that could be going forward. And it's true in this case. It's probably true in other infections as well. It's also, I think, making hospitals as clean as possible, too. And that sort of links into the other aspect of what we've talked about, too, and that we need to do everything we can to reduce the transmission of microbes in hospitals or healthcare settings. We need to do everything we can to improve the defenses of the body against these infections.
Now, one of the problems that seems to be arising in Montreal and Quebec, though, is that when the doctors say, let's isolate the patients, there aren't enough beds, there's not enough space, is this going to push up against the limits of the financing and the structure as it exists now of the healthcare system?
Well, I think that when you look at operating expenses over many years and compare them to capital expenses, making a bigger hospital with more private rooms, you know, usually you're going to show, and I think that people are going to become more aware of this and understand it, that the long-term cost savings far as outweigh the short capital outlay in terms of, you know, the push, I think, is going to continue to be to getting all hospital rooms single-patient rooms.
Okay. Let me ask you the last and the biggest question, I think. Is this, if, as an epidemiologist, medical epidemiologist, does it look to you like this is going to be contained in Montreal and where it's about breaking out in the United States, or is this likely to spread further?
I think it's likely to spread further. I think that as hospitals get more experienced, it's going to continue to challenge them, but it's also going to make them better if they respond the right way, and that is to rise to the occasion and do everything they can to make their hospitals safer.
Okay, should people be worried that this could rise to the level of something like avian influenza or the other the common flu that's on its way?
I think the fact that it's so linked to antibiotic use, we don't need to be concerned about it to that degree, because unlike avian or even SARS, you know, which attacked persons who were healthy living in the community, we've not seen that with Clostridium difficile. There was, I know, and probably you saw it, report in the news yesterday of two healthcare workers in Montreal who presumably were not receiving antibiotics, although they didn't quite specify that. They acquired this. We've not seen that developing in the United States, and certainly two healthcare workers compared to the large number of patients who've been affected makes you know, everything suggests this will continue to be a disease predominantly among patients who are receiving antibiotics. And for that fact alone, I think we can be assured that it will remain much more contained than the concerns about pandemic influenza.
Okay, so the best way to avoid it is to avoid going into a hospital, and if you do, to avoid taking massive doses of antibiotics.
Yeah, I think at the same time we know that there's a whole lot that hospitals can offer that's life-saving. So
right.
We don't want that message to scare people from
right.
the care they need. So I think what it is that for the patient, for the person, the public, to voice their concerns or share their concerns with their clinician about the Clostridium difficile problem, ask them the questions about whether the healthcare facility they're coming to is having problems, if they're aware of the problems.
Should people ask to see, and should hospitals publish records of their experience in this area, so people can differentially go to hospitals that have lower outbreak levels?
Well, that's something that's been proposed and being grappled with in Canada, certainly right now, and I believe the province of Quebec and maybe Ontario has taken that approach. And some states in the United States have taken the approach of public report card type public reporting. Of course, CDC has no regulatory authority in that regard.
Does anyone?
States do, yes.
Okay.
States do, and states have done that. And we are actually actively giving input for some of those states in terms of how best to do it. I think if it's going to be done, if public reporting is going to be enforced and required, you certainly want measures that make sense.
Has CDC issued some sort of model guidelines for that?
We are actually working on that with the Hospital Infections Control Practices Advisory Committee, and if drafts are not out already, they will be imminently, and I'm not sure the timeline on those. I apologize.
Okay, good. SARS broke out in Toronto. This incident is taking place in Montreal. Is there something about Canada lately that's responsible for this, or is it just a coincidence?
Well, the only question might be whether the patient room situation might be very different from some U.S. hospitals that we're talking here about having four patients per room commonly.
Right.
And I don't really have the data to tell you whether that's materially different in Montreal hospitals compared to most U.S. hospitals. But that has been raised as a possible issue.
So there's a kind of trade-off. People want to get cheaper drugs from Canada. Some of them are going, or at least were going, to Canada to get flu shots they couldn't get in the U.S. On the other hand, these infections are happening, so it's a kind of mixed bag, medically speaking.
Yeah, I don't really know that I could say, though, that the quality, I don't think this necessarily...
It reflects on the quality of health care in Canada?
Right.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for all this information, and we'll see what happens in a few more weeks, and maybe we'll get back to you again. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye.